Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic on Tour. I have such a special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Richard Grannan, a returning guest who has been to our public house twice, I think it is now.
It is.
To talk about narcissistic people whom I know, and who is known as a life coach who looks at, in particular, at this issue du jour, which is the old narcissism. And as you may recall, if you've watched the show, I interviewed him first about a chap who was a very good friend of mine when I was at school, and who he took the view was basically a dark triad character. And then the second time about a nutcase with whom I was at university, who bit me on the ear because I snogged his ex-girlfriend. And so now, chaps, I thought we could look a bit more into Richard Grannan, narcissist coach, the man. And if you're not familiar with it, he has written a memoir.
Yes.
What's it called now, this memoir?
A Cult of One.
A Cult of One. A Cult of One. Mm. But it was, as he said, when he was down the Jolly Heretic, it was a memoir that for the American audience had to be
declawed.
How would you put it?
Defanged.
Defanged.
Yeah, yeah.
Defanged memoir.
Yeah, defanged memoir.
And so perhaps today we can explore its shiny, sharp, saber-toothed tiger. Fangs, and look at what it was that has made Richard into this well-known internet celebrity and narcissism coach. So, tell me then. You've told me a bit about this before, but you with your me with my posh accent went to state school, and you with your Liverpudlian accent went to private school. But repeat again. What was the background childhood that you're?
I'm from Bebbington, which is on the Wirral, which is next to Liverpool, and Scousers, real Scousers would say I have a posh accent, but to the rest of the world I sound Scouse. At the age of 8, the family moved to Portugal, and I was there until I was 12, and then I was sent to boarding school in the UK, where my family stayed in Portugal, and then. At age 18, my school was saying to me, "Oh, you're a very clever chap. We think we can send you to Cambridge, where you can do Portuguese and Spanish." Because I'd learned Spanish as a kid, and then I learned Portuguese in Portugal. Then I learned Spanish in school, and it was easy for me because I was a kid. So my language levels were quite high for my age, and so they said, "Go to Cambridge." I wanted to go into intelligence. Ultimately through the army, and they said, "Well, go do language at Cambridge, it's perfect." And then in a moment of hubris, I was like, "Well, if they think I could go to Cambridge, maybe I could go to Oxford and do PPP." When they said, "Please don't try and do that." And I was rejected for that. Unsurprisingly, I wasn't the right candidate for it. And so I then went and studied at Aston.
Now, that's a bit weird, though, isn't it? Because Oxford and Cambridge, they're very good universities, and normally people that get rejected from them go to places like Durham or Bristol or London or Exeter or somewhere.
Yeah.
So Aston's a sort of ex-poly or something, isn't it? Why did you want to go there for?
I was grumpy. Durham accepted me for psychology and philosophy, and I think Warwick did as well. And my teachers were saying to me, "Well, you wanted to do psychology, philosophy, physiology, so go there." And I was like, "No, I'm sick of this university system. I hate you all. If I go to Aston, I'll get a job very quickly." And that's what Aston promises. And that's what Aston delivered. They said, if you have a psychology degree attached to Aston Business School, you'll get employed quickly. And I was. They delivered. I had something like three fast-track graduate jobs in the first 6 months of leaving. And so they were very good for that. But it was a deeply cynical choice, and I really, really regret it.
Why do you regret it?
Because I studied behavioural psychology for 3 years, and I'm not a behavioural psychologist. I don't, you know, I mean, I should have been, if I was going to study psychology, I now realise I should have been doing probably psychoanalytic theory from the get-go, where we were not allowed to discuss psychotherapy, psychoanalysis. You couldn't mention Freud's name on my course.
Mm-hmm.
It was Skinner. It was Pavlov. It was.
But they have empirically testable, verifiable results.
Of course, you would like it, Edward.
Don't you, Edward? Me. only my Auntie Ethel would call me. I transferred from Edward to Ed when I started working for the Royal Bank of Scotland at 18, and some people just randomly called me Ed or Ted.
Yeah.
And then they asked me at the Royal Bank of Scotland, Edward or Ed, and I was like, I'm Ed.
Yeah.
And then it just became Ed.
Yes.
And I had to stop fighting my parents a pound every time they didn't call me Ed and call me Edward instead. Yeah. so that they got used to, like, Pavlovian. They got used to the financial pain of empirically testable results.
Nice, nice. Well, you see, this is the dividing line in the room between the airy fairy woo woo side of psychology.
It's not a line. It's a chasm.
And data-based, data-driven
psychology. It's got to be driven by data. I mean, there's no... I don't know if you've read Ernst Gellner's book on psychoanalysis. No. I mean, there's just no evidence it works.
No, that's right.
As an empirical theory.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It doesn't. So what really it is, is a sort of... is therapy cloaked in doggerel, cloaked in nonsense.
Yeah, there was a paper released out of Liverpool University, one Scouser, two Cockneys, all professors, and they used the same qualitative measures that you would apply to medicine to psychoanalytic theory, and they said, oh no, psychiatry broadly, sorry, not psychoanalytic theory, psychiatry broadly, and said, this is 90% quackery. And so psychoanalytic theory would be classed as that, and yet... I would still claim it's a if the person wielding it is skilled, it's very, very useful.
Yeah, but what they're skilled in is not, as it were, is not overtly what they're skilled in. It's a covert skill.
Yes.
What they're skilled in, I suggest, is having a certain charisma, having an ability to listen, having an ability to induce the other person to think about themselves and make sense of whatever trauma or problem or whatever it is that they have been through.
Yeah.
Whereas what they are drilled in is this non-empirical notion of Freudian ideas or Jungian ideas or Adler or whatever.
Yeah, it's quasi-occult. It's
that's what Gellert argued.
Oh, really?
And it's very interesting as well. It's a bit like Christianity.
Mm.
That every priest, if they wanted to, are you a Catholic, Liverpudlian?
Well, ostensibly, yes, I suppose.
A lot of them are, yes. Irish.
Irish, yes.
Every priest, if he wanted to, could trace a kind of priest family tree back to Jesus. This person ordained him, this person ordained the bishop, this person ordained.
Yeah.
All the way back to Jesus, who was ordained by John the Baptist. But basically, he's the great unordained ordainer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Freud is. He's the great unpsychoanalyzed psychoanalyzer.
He
psychoanalyzed himself.
Yes, yeah, I 1,000% agree. And yet, given the career path that I took and my interests, I wish I had. I wish I'd gone that route, because I can make that work. I do make it work. And now you've got me thinking, though. The thing with I hated the behavioral psychology degree at the time, but they made us do experiments. We had to run our own experiments and we had to partake in other students' experiments. And that forced me to see the potential flaws in the scientific method, and it forced me to study statistics, which is not my thing. Mathematics is not my thing at all, but I had to have that in order to pass. And so maybe that helped a little bit.
Yes. Well, what were the flaws in your view? It's flawed in so much as you're wanting to apply it to a therapeutic approach.
You mean
behaviorism and studying that stuff?
I don't even know if I would say it's flawed. I just don't like it. It didn't interest me. We want to put rats in T-shaped mazes and measure how they respond statistically to this stimulus versus that. Well, put one punishment there, a reward there, and how many times did they do it? If it wasn't observable and couldn't be written down and weighed, they weren't interested.
That's science.
Well, I wasn't interested in science, but I didn't realize I was doing a BSc. I didn't look at. I got there, and instead of pulling the ripcord and saying I was in a really bad state of mind, the Oxford thing really hurt my ego. It really hurt my ego.
Do you have quite an ego, do you?
I certainly did when I was 18, because I'd been told I'd had my head gassed. I was told I was brilliant. I was told I was really very exceptional. And I thought, because I had friends who'd gone in the years above me, who'd gone through, and they'd gone to this college and that college, and I was already making my plans to hang around with them and everything. I thought it was in.
Mm.
And then Oxford was like, no, absolutely no chance. And I was like, well, really?
Is that what they wrote? Did they write a letter to your school that was very negative?
And no, they wouldn't even interview me.
Oh.
Which was unheard of. And my school, the headmaster who'd studied at Oxford, was like, this is unprecedented. You have to interview him. You've never rejected one of our students for interview before. And they said, no, we just can't interview him. Won't interview him.
Oh, gosh.
Which is unusual.
It is.
Yeah.
Not these days, but it was then, I think.
Yeah. Hurt my little feelings.
Yeah, hurt your little feelings. and so you did your... You, well, we'll get back... a lot of this is going to be about feelings. Mm. So you get back to your psychology degree.
Yeah.
And then what did you do after that?
Well, I wanted to join... Sorry for the microphone. I speak into the microphone, Richard. I wanted to join the army. But I needed time to train first. I wanted to go to Sandhurst as an officer. I wanted the parachute regiment was my hope. And I came out of university, and I think one of the first graduate fast track jobs I got was in the probation service. Are you from the Wirral? You're from the North West.
My grandfather was born in Everton.
In Everton. And your name Dutton is from
Cheshire. Dutton in Great Budworth.
Great Budworth.
There's a manor in Great Budworth called Dutton.
Dutton.
That's the name. So I'm two generations removed from that area. Yeah. My great-great-grandfather lived in the... He built railways in that area of England. Yeah, civil engineer. Mm. And he was from New Ferry.
That's down the road from me. I'm from Bebbington. Yeah. I used to taxi in New Ferry.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have a great-great-grandfather, George Dutton, who died in World War One. We might be distantly related.
We definitely are distantly related.
Talking to a scientist. We might be distantly related. We definitely are.
It's almost certain. If it's that surname,
yeah.
Then the question is, you are almost certainly related to Odard, first Lord of the Manor of Dutton, who came over in 1066. Yeah. okay.
The reason I asked is because I was stuck in a probation service in a place called Runcorn. I was... given the role at age 21 of delivering a course in cognitive behavioural therapy to criminals who were criminals by virtue of the fact they were drug addicts. And it was, they had a choice. You either do custodial sentence or you do this course. And it was part of the deal that they would make. And they had to sign in and sign out. It was a 10-week course, cognitive behavioural based course, where I would say useful things to rooms full of men who were career criminals and drug addicts, like the next time you think about taking heroin, let's consider the consequences of your actions. I lasted not very long, a few months. I couldn't take it. They were smoking crack in the breaks and all kinds of things.
So they didn't think about it very hard?
No. The impulse control of these men was not high enough to even tolerate what I was, a six-hour course. So I did that for a little while. The other fast track graduate thing I got was with Aldi. I was an area manager for Aldi for a while. And then whilst I was waiting to join the army, what they do is they give you potential officer courses where you visit different regiments. I said I wanted the parachute regiment, but my recruiting officer, Colonel Amlow from Liverpool, he wanted me for the Kings. So he said, just try different regiments and then they take you on different courses. You go and live with the officers for 3 or 4 days and you do their assault courses and you train with the men and stuff. So I was doing that and I got to the point where it was nearly time for my RCB, which is the test for Sandhurst.
What does that stand for?
I don't know what RCB stands for anymore. it's your final test for Sandhurst. It's a
Royal Conscription Board?
Something along those lines. And It's a 5-day physical and mental test. So they, in each regiment, because you're a potential officer and they can sort of choose you, they will give you initiations and preparations for the RCB to prep you for that. So I felt well prepped and I was due to go. And the night before the RCB, I decided to go out with my friends drinking in Chester. And I got glassed in the face in a bar called Love Street, which is on Love Street in Chester. And a guy had headbutted me shoved a glass in my
face. How did you manage to get into a situation where you were glassed in the face in one of the most genteel county towns in the UK?
Very good question. I've actually got lifelong injuries from genteel county towns. That's one. I've got permanent, so it's very small and I have wrinkly eyes, so you can't really see it anymore. But I still have bits of glass in my nose and in the bag under my eye. I had my eardrum burst in Chester and in York, which is a beautiful city. Mm. I had my jaw broken.
What is it about you and upsetting the working class people of genteel county towns?
In Chester, it's because the guy was homophobic and he had decided I was gay, which I am not, as far as I'm aware. Though we have discussed the plasticity of human sexuality across time.
And you did go to a private school, boarding school.
Boarding school, even.
So presumably you had a few tickles.
One couldn't not.
No.
But he...
certain difficult masters.
Yes, he was very, very angry with my gayness for reasons I can't fathom. And yes, he said he approached me on the dance floor. They have this on CCTV, and said, "You dance like a faggot." And I said, "Yes, I've had a lot of practice." And he didn't think that was funny. So he headbutted me, had a half pint glass in his hand, smashed it into my face. The doorman caught him. Police had him. He did 9 months in the end. He got banged up for it. And that set me back a little bit. I was a bit shocked.
So then you went to York to have your jaw broken?
I can't remember whether York was before or after. I did get into quite a few brawls when I was around that age.
Yeah, I don't know why it is. I mean, I've had three people in the studio today and two of them get into quite a few brawls.
Yeah. And you nearly had Tommy Robinson in.
I nearly had Tommy Robinson, yeah. And he and he would have, he's got into a few scrapes.
Yes.
I mean, just come on. And you're posh. I mean, I'm at state school, mate. I never got into a brawl.
Never been a brawler, no.
No, not since like junior school. So. So you were glassed in the face in Chester.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
My confidence took a hit because I struggled to deal with the fact that I knew it happened. I knew people were beaten up for being gay or like race-based attacks, but I had not. It really shook my worldview. The guy had left his house that night and gone to a club that was known for having gay people there, specifically to target somebody and to glass them in the face. And I couldn't quite wrap my head around that. So in the months afterwards, I took a month off work, and then I decided...
Why did you go to this gay club at all?
Well, to not get glassed. Oddly enough, there was, I think, what's the chain we have here that's usually full of ruffians? Is it O'Neill's? Or, well, there is an it wasn't an O'Neill's, it's
Wetherspoons.
So right opposite Love Street there's a Wetherspoons, and so we're all private school boys with two of our girlfriends from the girls school. It was Birkenhead Boys School and Birkenhead Girls School, and we said, well, where should we go? We only want a few drinks and then we're going to go home because I've got the RCB the next day. We said, we can't go to Wetherspoons, we'll get battered, so let's go to the gay club.
Is this Birkenhead Bluecoat School?
No. Oh. I'm not even sure if the Bluecoat School is even... I can't even... there's St. Anselm's was Birkenhead, where they wore blue coats, and I think it's gone now.
Oh, okay.
But it was a good... That's a good private school.
Mm, mm. So you got battered, and you're being a gay, and your confidence took a bit of a hit, and you took time off work.
Took time off, and Colonel Amlow was saying to me, "Come on, you know, get back on the horse. Don't let this bother you." He'd been glassed. He had like a really cool looking scar across his chin from being glassed in a barroom brawl. He was a tough old chap.
In Chester?
I don't know where he was glassed.
A gay bar.
But I needed time out, so I went to do admin work, some very, very simple customer service work in Liverpool. And the team that they put me on had two nightclub bouncers on it. And we just started talking. I'd always been into martial arts. They were asking me about martial arts. They were like, "Martial arts, that shite, that doesn't work. You know, it's a load of garbage." And I was like, "Oh, some of it's pretty good." Like, "Nah, it's nonsense." That, and I was like, "Well, okay, we'll go to the gym." So we went to the gym and I showed them a few things. Like, "Wow, that's boss. I'm going to use that on the weekend." So my thing, I'd been into martial arts for a long time, different styles and stuff. But what we now call MMA, when this is back in 99, 2000, it wasn't big then. you know, the cage fighting.
Yes.
Back then it would either be called valet tudo or shoot fighting. And I'd done it, but there weren't many places who had, there weren't many people who had, it was still brand new. So they were like, oh, you know, you're handy, we'll stick you on one of the doors with us. And I went, yeah, fine, I'll do office work at the weekends and I'll do door work. Sorry, office work during the week, door work at the weekends. I'd always fancied it, thought it would be a laugh. And that was me for about 5 or 6 years.
Did you have to give anybody a severe beating?
Oh, yes.
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 Did the martial arts come in handy with that beating?
It did.
Just traditional fisticuffs?
Oh, traditional fisticuffs sometimes. Sometimes a bit of rough and tumble, and sometimes a damn good thrashing.
Damn good thrashing, like at your boarding school. Was that a bit traumatic, being sent away to live away at 12?
Yeah, 12. It was for the first week. So the life in Portugal for me was very... Most of my friends, they were all expats. They were a multinational group. Everybody spoke English, but they were like Dutch and German and Portuguese and English. And they were all around 15, 16 years old. So I was used to hanging around with older kids. And it was, we had a lot of freedom. We could sneak into nightclubs and get hold of alcohol. And it was like a sort of outdoorsy life. And then I was in a fairly religious boarding school, and me and this boarding school just didn't get along at all for the first couple of weeks. And then I just learned their system and their rules, and I was quite comfortable there. It was all right. Got on with the teachers, got on with the students, learned the rules. Most of the kids went home at the weekends because it was more of a day school.
Mm. This is the Birkenhead place?
No, this is, it's called Queen's. It's Queen's College Taunton.
Oh, right, in Devon.
Yeah, down in Somerset.
Somerset. Mm.
And so the weekends I just read, and then my mates would come back during the week, and it was all right. That wasn't particularly traumatic. It was okay.
No teacher noncery.
There were nonces there, yeah. Well, most of the noncery was from the older kids. The teachers were pretty good. There was only one teacher, and he was known for it, and everybody kind of stayed away from him. But the older kids were quite noncey.
Hmm.
Yeah.
There's a lack of females, you see.
Well, yes, and there were females there, but they sort of kept them away from us. Like, geographically, they were sort of secluded from us. And some of the lads just liked it, I think. They were just into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was it dominance games?
Yes, because it was, well, you know from private school, the way traditional British schooling works is you obey anybody who's older than you. And then once they become 16, 17, 18, they're automatically designated as prefects. So they can issue fatigues, they can issue punishments. So if they tell you to stand out or clean something or go and do something, and they issue fatigue, you have to do it in the same way as if a teacher issued it to you. So yeah, they were sort of getting into noncey stuff whilst punishing kids. Yeah,
yeah. I've got a cat, and he's very sociable, very pro.
He's not a nonce, is he?
We've had to buy him a cat, like his own cat. It's not our cat. It's just like a semi-feral cat.
Right.
We can't touch it. It won't let us stroke him. It won't. This new cat.
That's his cat.
That's his cat.
It's like a prison scenario.
So but that cat is semi-feral,
right?
Like a foundling.
Yeah.
So he won't let us stroke him. It won't let us pick him up.
Yeah.
But it needs my other cat Sulu to get food and to you know, so Sulu kind of on the one hand it's his friend and they play together, but then if the other cat plays with Sulu's toys too much, then he gets beaten up.
Yeah.
And mounted. And if the other cat looks like he's enjoying himself with us a bit too much, we're his family.
Right.
So he gets mounted and beaten up,
bitten,
held down, bitten on the neck. And it used to be that I'd wake up in the morning and the cat would be like, meow, what attention to be played with. But now he doesn't because he's got his cat.
Yeah.
It is his cat.
He's the daddy.
And I don't know why. It's ridiculous that I have a cat. It's a very sociable cat, you see.
Yeah.
But like, I have to buy him a cat. I can have nothing to do with. I can't touch it.
Your cat has a cat.
Our cat has a cat, yeah.
That's my cat.
It's his cat. No, it's very much his cat. So the other night, he just sort of turned to his cat and went, meow, and then like, follow me to bed. It's bedtime.
Really? Come on.
Slept in our bedroom.
Yeah.
But we can't go near it. It's his cat. I don't know if anyone else out there has a cat that has a cat. But worth doing. If you have a very pro-social cat, basically a cat that's like a dog that needs to be entertained and whatever, and then get it a cat.
Yeah.
But it's cat.
That's don't get confused. That's
kind of a narcissistic element to that, really.
It is really. Yeah.
I mean, I didn't realise that Sulu had narcissistic traits until I've seen him dominate this cat and just use him. And the other cat, there's no any different because all he knows is the only person that's my species.
Yeah,
is this? It's just like Stockholm syndrome. I mean, yeah. he just sort of gravitates towards being abused. I don't know what else I can do. I'm certainly not going to get him a cat.
No, there would be infinite regress.
It would continue forever. So that was the nonsense that's going on at the moment. Where were we? So you, beaten up Chester, took a knock, nightclub bouncer now,
mm-hmm.
and with your psychology degree, which you didn't like, and what did you do from there?
Got shouted at by my teachers when they saw me on the door. They were like, Grannon! What are you doing? And I'd go from being nightclub doorman, because I was a head doorman on this place from a young age, like 15 years old, if they saw me. So everybody was terribly disappointed with me and thought I'd thrown my life away. And I did that for 5 or 6 years. And then because of the people I was around with and the stuff I was doing, eventually I got into trouble, which was inevitable. It was just inevitable. Quite serious trouble.
What did you do?
It's a long time ago. The head doorman got quite badly hurt by a gang of lads, and then I quite badly hurt the
this
gang
where?
Of lads. This is Liverpool.
Ah.
Yeah, a place. What street is that? It's not Dale Street. Maybe it's Dale Street. The club's not there anymore. It's gone. But there was a gang of lads that we'd had trouble with. And, they opened my head doorman's face up down to the bone through his nose and through his lip with a bottle. And I wasn't there when it happened. I came out sort of like 30 seconds after it had happened. And then there was a repercussion. I was upset.
Mm.
It got myself into quite a lot of trouble. So that was the end of
my book. So you gave someone a slap?
Yeah. A slap that required plastic surgery to recover from.
Right, it's quite a big slap.
Three lads got a slap. That was, it was really great. I had problems. I had like unresolved.
It's martial arts kind of slap.
Yes-y. Yeah. But people listening might think, oh, that sounds justified. It really wasn't.
Right, open the guy's face up.
They deserved something. They deserved like a bit of a beating. But not what I did. I couldn't work the door anymore. Couldn't go into Liverpool. Had to resolve that, which was a tricky process. But thankfully, it was resolved with the people involved with that. And then I was a taxi driver for a while. Taxi driver, 6 months, maybe a year. Set up my own chauffeuring business. Was doing okay with that. And a friend of mine who was a friend of my father's, that my father had pushed towards me because I wouldn't go to therapy, but I would speak to this guy, a Scouser, who had lived in a Buddhist monastery and he was into chanting and spirituality and the New Age and stuff. So he was having chats with him that was, I realise now, was therapy, but we weren't calling it therapy because I was not well. I was not mentally well. I had like quite bad anger management issues. And he, this chap, said to me, would you like to work with school children? And I said, no.
I would have thought you would be banned from working with school children if you had a criminal record for beating somebody up so badly that they've plastered.
I thankfully didn't get a criminal record. We had to sort it out.
Out of court settlement?
You could call it that, yes. Yeah. 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 Money exchanged hands and we didn't involve it. I've got police in my family and they knew about it and they're like, you're fucked. If you come to us, you go to prison. It will be classed as attempted murder, not just GBH. I said, well, it could be maybe just a bit of a fight that got out of hand. And they said, nope, it won't be seen as that. It'll be seen as attempted murder, which would have taken my life in obviously an awful, awful day. I've never talked about this before publicly.
Yeah.
I might regret this, but that happened.
Go on a little side tour, if you don't mind.
Okay.
It's quite a big thing you've just admitted to. Okay, a long time ago.
But it is.
But young and fueled with testosterone and whatever.
Cocaine.
Cocaine, perhaps. Oh, God, a little cocaine around. So you're cocaine. So you're paranoid, maybe, as well, and things like that.
Steroids.
Steroids.
Mm-hmm. Takes note.
So I don't just, forget what I'm,
writing
what I'm
that
dealing
down,
with here.
Mr. Grannan. Can we call the police?
there's a bit of a problem. The safety word is banana. No, they have this idea, I don't know if you're familiar with it, a book by the Catholic priest called Henri Nouwen, The Wounded Healer. And the idea is that a person that does what you do, i.e. you basically give people therapy that have problems, particularly problems in their life with narcissists, has often been through terrible things themselves. Mm-hmm. And because of that, they are better able to intuitively understand their what word do we use, patient, subject, whatever. And therefore, they are better able to heal those problems. No, the charismatic, the Weberian charismatic, the wounded healer. And you give me the impression that you're almost a stereotype I've read your book as well, but a stereotype of something like this. So why did it get to the point where you're taking steroids and coke and beating somebody up so badly that it could be classed as attempted murder? I mean, what is this, just genetic, or is there something that happened? I mean, what's the matter?
It's partly genetic. It's partly genetic, I think. Yeah, I do think so. I think this is going to be potentially a really tricky interview for you in terms of repercussions.
For me?
Well, it's you'll be hosting it. On my father's side, they are travellers, and in his family there was a lot of criminality. And you are an evolutionary psychologist. You look at the genetic impact on personality and behaviour, and there was problems. There was alcoholism, there was really bad criminality running through there, and self-destruction, a big streak of self-destruction. And I do wonder if there's like a genetic component to what I did in my 20s. But I'd also experienced, before boarding school, I'd experienced like sexual abuse and physical abuse. Yeah. That's where the anger was coming from. That's where all the rage was coming from. Like psychological and sexual abuse.
Who did this to you?
Would you go and beat them up for me?
I'll ring Tommy Robinson and see if he can...
He'd bring the lads around.
And then he'll be caught in traffic and not turn up.
Tommy, he's never getting over this traffic thing, mate. It was people close to the family who were supposed to be taking care of me and my father. My father was jailed for sexual assault of his children. He had more than one family, in his first family.
Your father was married twice.
Yeah.
And he sexually abused not you, but his first...
He did sexually abuse me, but he didn't go to prison for that. He got 11 years for various crimes. I'm saying way too much in this interview. What is it, this effect you are having on me?
I don't know. It's unusual. And so what we were saying earlier was the same with Katie Hopkins and Count Dankula. Yeah. The chaps, you know, I'm known for doing these interviews online, and that's how I have to do them because I live in Finland. But there's something about being in the same room, you know, that, well, perhaps you'll bring out all kinds of stuff out of me on Sunday if we do an interview then.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's pretty awful. And so, presumably, as a child, what kind of age did these things?
Five. Up until I was 8, and then we shifted countries, and then in the other country when I was 10 and 11, then at boarding school I was stalked and groomed by an 18-year-old Canadian boy for a year. Who would come into the... Because there was only foreign students with foreign families would stay at the school on the weekends. So at the weekends, we were very vulnerable. I fortunately was dormed with a Japanese boy, and he protected me a couple of times from this Canadian boy who was stalking me would come in and molest me when I was asleep. And it was the Japanese kid would wake up and, like, he was 18 and this kid's 13, like, hit him with a hockey stick or something to get him off me. But, yeah, there was a guy who was trying to, nonce me.
Yes.
Yes.
So what was the 5 to 8 and then 13, or what he said. And so what was the, at the time when you were between five and eight and your family, friends and father are doing it, what was, how did you feel about it? What kind of thing did you think? Did you think it was just normal or what?
No, I knew it wasn't normal. I knew it wasn't normal. I struggled with it. I felt horrible. I mean, in my adult life, it's given me all kinds of problems in relationships. I have this strange thing where if I'm sleeping with a woman in the same bed, I'll try not to fall asleep touching her because I think I have some corruption or evil in me. It's an unconscious thought. It's not a conscious thought, but I won't touch them if I'm sleeping. If I wake up and I'm touching them when I'm asleep, I disengage from them because I think there's something dark and evil in me that will go into them.
Why do you think there's something dark in you? It's something other people have done to you.
Children lack the boundaries at that age, and also sexual abuse erodes boundaries anyway, to understand that an external object is doing it to the subject. So everything is subject. So I am my father. I am even the room in which the abuse takes place. And so then everything is me, narcissistically, solipsistically, in the child's mind. And so if there is evil, then I must be
if
evil.
If there is evil, then you have somehow absorbed the evil.
Yes.
Yeah. Into you.
Yes. Yeah.
It's magical thinking.
You've absorbed
the evil of the room. It's like, yes, religious. Yes, you've, if you go into a dangerous, evil place, you become evil.
Yes.
If you touch a pariah, then you become unclean.
I'm unclean, yes.
So you're unclean because you've touched the thing that's doing the unclean thing.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. And that was how you made sense of what was going on.
Yes. Are you Christian?
Sometimes.
You said, why did I do the terrible things I did? There's a quote from the Gospel of Thomas that didn't make it into the mainstream Bible. It's a Gnostic Gospel where Jesus says, if what is within you is brought forth from you, what is within you will save you. If what is within you is not brought forth from you, what is within you will destroy you. And I think I shouldn't have been a nightclub bouncer. And there was a lot inside of me that needed to be expressed, that needed to come out of me. And I think it was driving me completely fucking mad. It was destroying me. It wasn't brought forth, and so it started to destroy
me. So you had all these awful negative thoughts that you were evil, and you would, in moments of anger, I don't know, project these onto other people.
Yes.
And so in a very sort of pop psychology way, you're attempting to murder Richard Grannan.
Yeah, well, I never laid hands on somebody of a different ethnicity. And I noticed this around the world. I've done nightclub security in different places in the world. The worst violence is that I've seen is intraracial. So I couldn't project that hatred and rage on somebody if they were black or Chinese, but if they looked like me and sounded like me, they were going to get it.
That's very interesting in terms of what people like Hope Not Hate do, who project hatred onto other white people.
Mm-hmm.
The left do, the white left, it's all the other white people who they hate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they see themselves in them and they see the bad side of themselves.
Yeah, I've got you.
They can't deal with them.
That's what I wanted to ask you. So a slight sidetrack. I won't linger there. Is it true that white people are higher in traits for neurosis than other races? And that's why we do the self-flagellation thing?
It depends which traits. So neuroticism is a series of different sub-traits. African black people, whatever, are high in things like anger.
Mm.
That's a neurotic trait. Mm. But they're low in things like anxiety, social anxiety,
right.
that sort of thing. Guilt.
Mm.
I think that East Asians are very low in things like anger and whatever, but they're high in things like social anxiety.
Mm.
We are some mishmash of this in the middle.
Okay.
So it's perfectly possible, yeah, that we are, certainly we're high in social anxiety, probably, I think guilt, it could be, I don't know. I'd have to see if that's been done, but it may well be that East Asians are lower in guilt, but higher in social anxiety, i.e. shame.
Yeah.
And that for some reason we are particularly high in guilt, which would make a lot of sense of Ruth Benedict's guilt culture, shame culture thing. And then the self-flagellation is people that are high in neuroticism, and it comes from there. My understanding is that self-harm, which that is, is definitely associated with autism, it's associated with neuroticism, and it's that they... If they're very depressed, then it makes them feel something because it releases, at least in a small way, endorphins and adrenaline. Mm-hmm. It's a cry for help if other people see it. Or is there some other aspect to it? Just self-punishing.
So the woke left movement seems to be largely fueled by white people.
Externalising their own self-loathing.
That's what I'm wondering, yeah.
Onto other white people. I think that's probably true. And you can see that the studies indicate that 50% of very left-wing women under the age of 30 have been to doctors about mental disorders. And so you can see that the kind of girl that, you know, cuts herself or burns herself because she's sad is absolutely the kind of girl that's going to be sucked into things like autogynephilis, transsexuality.
Yeah.
LGBT, all this stuff.
It's almost hand in glove with the pre-existing mental health.
Yeah,
disorders.
So it's like she's cutting society because she's sad. I once tried to write a poem when I was about 21 about this girl that engaged in self-harm. It was such a ridiculous poem. I was trying to be very profound and whatever, you know, comparing the marks to lipstick or whatever. And my friend just turned around and said, so basically, Ed, what your poem should be is this. She cuts herself because she's sad.
that end that poem.
Yeah, that's
like,
summed it up.
I won't write this poem.
it's a bad subject. It's non-poetic. Okay, so you had these unresolved issues.
Yes.
And did one of the ways that people resolve this bad feelings about themselves, it's associated with neuroticism, as you mentioned earlier. But neuroticism, for those that aren't familiar with it, is feeling negative feelings strongly. It's one of the big five personality traits, along with openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, and agreeableness. Ocean is narcissism. Did you go through a process then of adopting that to cope?
Narcissism, I couldn't. I think I tried. I think if there's anything in me in the narcissistic space, it would be failed narcissism. I tried it, but I couldn't get the delusion to stick. I think I'd be much closer to a borderline, especially in my late 20s when the violence happened, which is violence, especially in male borderlines. We know that male borderlines can be extremely physically violent, where male narcissists in that age group typically aren't. So I would have probably rung the bells for borderline personality disorder. And factor two psychopathy.
So borderline is, as we've discussed before on the show, and you've summed it up quite, is this idea that you have a fundamental fear of abandonment and of being alone and of sort of just a sense of that you're not, you know, who you are.
Yes.
And that someone attacking you, or physically or mentally, you know, induces those feelings of those. And also you have trouble controlling your emotions.
Yes.
And so someone, you know, slagging you off or whatever induces A, these feelings of alone, potential aloneness that you can't cope with, you can't deal with, that overwhelm you, and B, induce the anger or whatever, and so you just attack, you just go for it.
And there was an element of self-harm as well. I would always let people start first. I'd let them get the first few digs in, and I'd let them hit me a bit first. And then I'd go, okay, now we'll see. And I got something from that. I got an adrenaline rush, and I liked it. I was obsessed with the film and the book Fight Club, and there's a lot of self-harm in Fight Club. And so I liked the pain, and I liked being able to take the pain. And also I was in an environment where I would deliberately act up being a posh private school boy so that predators would be like, oh, this is going to be easy, this is going to be fun. And then I'd flip on them. I'd flip the switch, and then they would be terrified. And that was thrilling. I really enjoyed it. I did a test once. It's a D factor. It's called the D factor test for dark traits. And I scored fairly high for narcissism, about as much as you would expect somebody who runs a YouTube channel to. It's like, they said it's the same as like C-list, D-list celebrities are usually around this high. But sadism, I scored very, very high for sadism. Again, he's looking like he wants to call the police.
I'm glad there's no whips or chains in this weird dungeon room, padded cell. It's padded cell that we are in, chaps. No one can hear you screaming here. No, that's bollocks, they can. There's someone outside. But maybe he's in the pay of Richard Grannan, who knows. So you hadn't, and by this time you're in your mid-20s or whatever.
Yeah.
You hadn't dealt with your these demons.
No. Mm. And then, as I say, a friend of mine said, you want to speak to kids in school? I said, that's the last thing I want to do. I'd rather have my fingernails pulled out. And he said, well, just...
But you probably would enjoy a little bit as well.
Yes, I would have got something. I would have got something from that. And he said, just, it's not what you think. Just come and watch me do it. And he was doing like, he was classed as self-employed, but there was an agency based in Surrey that was sending out speakers to go and talk in schools for a full school day. So you're talking for about 5-6 hours to kids with behavioural problems to try and get them to sit still, memorise information and go and sit their exams. And within the scope of doing that, there was a syllabus that we had to deliver, and then there was things we could say to motivate and inspire them. And I saw him do it, and I was like, oh, that's pretty funny, that's pretty good. I think I could do a better job. And then I tried it, and then I ended up doing that for 5 years, and I was good at it. I became like a keynote speaker at the National Education Conference in 2008 or 2007, within 2 years of starting. I found I really liked public speaking. I really liked working with kids. I really liked, especially if they have behavioural problems. Like, oh, these kids are really naughty, they're violent, they're this, that. So that's great. Let's have a chat. Let's see what they have to say.
And what do you think it is within you that is able to get on with? I find, I don't know if this is relevant, but I find that I talk to everybody in the same kind of way.
You've cracked it. That's it. That's all you do.
And it doesn't matter whether they're... I get this in America. People are like, oh, God, what? You were talking to these black people in Detroit, weren't you? Scared? No. I was talking to them the same way I talk to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And white people don't generally do that. They kind of talk to them in a bit of a different way.
There's research on this, right?
They definitely,
and especially white liberals, code are switch. Worse.
They worse, yeah. They talk to them. They code. They talk to them. They talk down to them. They patronise them. And on some dim level... These people sort of understand that's what's going on.
Yeah.
And one of them actually remarked to me that normally white people don't talk to him like this. This has never happened before.
Yeah.
And they seem to, I just talk to them, I don't know anybody else.
Yeah.
Is that what you did to them?
100%. And deliberately and consciously. And when they asked me to train their other trainers, and I said, look, they're children, but they see themselves as potent and they're trying to fight their way through to adulthood. Their highest priority is not education, it's being cool. Like, coolness is their biggest currency, and they will act the way you treat them. So if you treat them like they're children, they'll act like children. If you treat them like young adults who are trying to get through a difficult life and get into the world, and you show them the respect that they do deserve, because they were from horrible family environments. They made my childhood like a fucking picnic. And I would speak to them with a degree of respect. I didn't have the... You know, what this patronizing vertical power dynamic implicit in what I was saying. I was speaking to them horizontally. Like, I'm a human being. They were just maybe 11 years younger than me.
Mm.
And I was like, life isn't a bowl of cherries. It's fucking tough. And this is a game you're in. And you don't want to be playing it, but you're going to play it. You're going to. There's no choice. We all have to. Now, what are you going to do? You can go out into the streets and be a pain in the ass, and eventually they'll throw you in prison. And then you'll know what a real tough guy is. Because that's where they stick real tough guys, real dumb tough guys. And you won't be the biggest fish in the pond, and it will frighten you and you will cry. Or you can play the game and work the system. Try and be smart. And that was it. All of my pitch was a sales pitch, essentially, for 5 hours. And it was, you know, try this thing, try academia, try education, try working and studying. And if you don't want to do that, then you're going to have to run a business, but then you're going to have to learn how to run a business, and that's really hard. And we would do that. And the schools were happy. The way you got jobs in that system was all on feedback. So if the students are happy, the teachers are happy, and the parents are happy, you get more work. And it's kept everybody happy, got a lot of work, and climbed up in that system. And I felt better. Because everything up until then, I was a bad boy. I was a bad object. And I kept on doing things and saying things that reinforced that I was, despite the privileges I'd had in my upbringing, that something inside of me genetically was just warped and dark, and I was going to be a career criminal, and that I was no better than just being a...
Did you make a conscious decision to break free of this bad boy dark thing? At some point, was there a sort of a lower step where you thought, look here, Richard, old chap, this is not going well, or was it just a gradual evolution?
When your great-grandparents were living in New Ferry... New Ferry was a nice place, and it was one of the wealthiest places in the world. It's where the wealthy people lived. Mm. When I got kicked off the doors and kicked out of Liverpool, I went and worked as a taxi driver in New Ferry. And with all due respect to people who live there, it's not a salubrious place now. It's a very, very low economy, low education environment with a lot of issues, a lot of drug issues, alcoholism, domestic violence. And I ran. There was two seagulls. They were either fighting or fucking. And there's what they do. I was at a roundabout where the KFC is, and they came under the car, and I couldn't stop, and I killed them both. And I was listening to a cassette version of Deepak Chopra's Synchro Destiny because I was into the new age. And I was just thinking, whatever happens, I can't be this person anymore. I have to stop. I have to stop. I have to change the path I'm on, because the path I was on was just dark. It was just a very, very dark path. I just didn't want to live in that space with those kinds of people, with those kinds of thoughts, that kind of energy around me. And I know, I made a choice. I
was like, so you had a moment of epiphany?
It was an epiphany. There was a couple of moments of epiphany.
By KFC, by virtue of killing...
Two fucking...
A seagull couple.
Yeah, a seagull couple. Sorry, seagull couple. There was that, and then... After the incident, the violent incident, before I'd sorted things out with the people who needed to have things sorted out with, I didn't sleep for 7 days. I was terrified. There was people looking for me, and they wanted to kill me. And if they couldn't get to me, they were going to get to family members who looked like me. So I was really terrified.
But were these yobbos with connections in the underworld?
Mm.
Yeah.
Direct. I'd actually done something to the son of somebody who was... So I really shouldn't have...
The daddy of Liverpool. There might have been a documentary I saw about him, actually.
Yes, there was. A viral. Was it, like, very, very popular?
Yeah.
He was my boss. So there's two people who are viral. You can say that. It's called, like, Liverpool's Hardest Debt Collector.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Sean Smith. That was my boss.
So that's who you were defending?
No, he wasn't the one who had his lip done. No. And I'd actually, at that point, I'd actually stopped working for him. He was running capital security for the Lynches. He was my first boss. I'd actually switched companies by then. At that time, I won't say who I was working for, but by day I was working for another person who's famous on YouTube, a guy called Stephen French. So there's two guys with viral YouTube videos. One's Stephen French, and the other one is Sean Smith. And I was working with Sean Smith originally, but no, that wasn't who I'd upset. It was a different person, who was the sparring partner, the boxing partner of my boss at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a big problem. It was a big problem. I mean, but I would have been furious as well. Like if that had happened to, even, it doesn't matter what the circumstances were. It was an excessive reaction. My reaction was excessive.
Yes. This was the externalizing of your various
undissolved. Yeah,
and
yeah.
So then you moved into this.
Sorry, I just have to say nothing about this as a brag. I'm not bragging about it. It was a terrible event, and you know I don't want people to see it now and think I've never talked about it before.
Ah.
So I don't want to reawaken stuff. Like it really was a terrible. I apologize to everybody who was involved, their parents and everything.
Fair enough. Mm. But you had this moment of epiphany anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into the school working and so on. And this is both you're good, you realize you're good at this,
yes,
and you enjoy it, and it's kind of therapeutic perhaps,
yes,
in a way.
It is, yeah.
And you're becoming known for it. And so how do we go on from there then in Shares Granum?
You're good at this.
Thank you.
At the time, I'd always been interested in internet marketing, and alongside of this, I had like a little online business. At first, I was selling ebooks on body weight exercises and bits of martial arts training. And whilst I was working in the schools, I developed a company. There's a guy who used to teach internet marketing for people who are interested, who know about internet marketing. He was very famous, got very rich very, very quickly, and then killed himself in a racing car. His name was Corey Riddell, who's a Canadian, and he released a course called How to Do Internet Marketing. 2003, very, very different scenario. 2002 it was. And he, in his course, he said somebody should buy the website, because it was still in the days of the dot-com boom where we were buying websites because that was the thing to do to make money. He said somebody should buy a website called kungfusecrets.com. And I was like, well, I can't teach kung fu, but I could teach street fighting. So I bought streetfightsecrets.com. And I was teaching self-defense online aside to the schools. The schools I couldn't stay inside of because they eventually headhunted me for a UK government campaign called Aim Higher. And my company handed me over to them, and Aim Higher wanted me to go around schools telling the kids that if they all went to university and became graduates, that they'd all make more money. But the data didn't, thank you for the eye roll, because people have argued with me on this. They said graduates do make more money.
They make more money if there's not many of them. If everyone's a graduate, they're not going to make more money, are they? For God's sake.
Yeah, exactly. There was actually a woman who's she's a doctor of psychology, and she argued that point with me. She was like, no, all graduates make more money. I was like, oh, okay. Well, that solves that then.
Diminishing returns on the relationship between the number of graduates and the making of more money, aren't they?
Rolls eyes.
Infinite amount of money to be made. And then if there is, you just devalue the money. So, I mean, look, come on.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, yes.
Yeah, so she was a master of statistics.
Yeah, she's like a stupid bloody woman.
So I kind of argued with them, and I said, well, you know, I will tell them that if they really have a passion for a career, that they should go. And they said, no, just tell all the students. And I was like, you just want me to get them into debt. You just want me to get them to go to university, make money for the university, and make money for the student loans company in the UK, which is, of course, owned by the government, and get them into tons of debt by the time they're 21 for the rest of their lives. I'm not doing that. So they kicked me out. And then I was just teaching self-defense full-time. Was good at that. Picked up a lot of clients from around the world. Not teaching... what people came to me for wasn't the physical stuff. It's that I was teaching the psychology of preparing for real-world violence. And that went... You know, the UK Riot Centre came for training. The Air Marshals, who back then it was much more important. The Air Marshals, it was like 2008, 2009. Don't use them as much now, but back then it was an important role. They were coming to me for consultations. So it was a successful small business in self-defense and psychology. In 2012, YouTube deleted my YouTube channel for being too violent. And I contested that. I said, you have clips from films like Saw here, where women who are screaming for mercy are having their feet sawn off or boiled alive. But me showing people how to defend themselves in real world scenarios, just saying it's too violent. There was even like sexual assault. It's from films, it's fictional, but it was still on YouTube. And they said, we won't host material like this. I said, you are hosting material like this. Way worse than anything I'm suggesting. But they deleted the channel. So that was a bit of a crisis financially, because all of my business came from YouTube. So I switched to... coaching the instructors who were coming to me, because often when we were having private conversations, it seemed that they were happy to teach people how to do violence, but then they weren't happy to assert their boundaries with their wife, their children, or to just say no. So these are guys who could go over to another part of the world and shoot an enemy in the head, but if somebody cut in front of them in the line at Starbucks, they were silent and frozen. So that's where the new project was born, SpartanLifeCoach.com.
Okay. And so SpartanLifeCoach.com, the main thing that you are known for focusing on is narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
And why has that been of particular interest to you? And why do you think as well, I mean, even some people that you have met for the first time today wanted to meet, it's been such a thing for them. We've become so aware of this in the last 10 years, narcissism and its consequences, and you're perhaps part of why. Why do you think that is?
It's probably arguable, a defensible position to say that since the 1950s until now, we've become, as a culture, more narcissistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably objectively verifiable. There's always been narcissism in human nature. It's a natural part of being a human being. But as we've grown more affluent and wealthy, and more addicted to luxury, which is something that you've pointed out a number of times.
I would like to address something briefly. In many of my videos, I talk about our evolutionary backgrounds and how our social behaviour today is naturally predisposed. But in doing so, I often assume that you have a basic knowledge of our evolutionary history. This includes not only our descent from apes, but also the history of how we differentiated into different races and peoples. Of course, you can watch all my videos and gather the information from the bits and pieces that I've done, as well as reading up on the sources yourself. But to make it easier for you, there is a good book called Who We Are and How We Got Here by Harvard psychologist Professor David Reich. This book is special because it was one of the first to incorporate the new findings of archaeogenetics. This means that DNA is extracted from ancient bone findings and analysed. Based on these data, we know exactly which peoples migrated from where to where and when. The ancestors of us Europeans, for example, the so-called Indo-Europeans or Yamnaya, probably came from the steppe around 3000 BC and conquered Europe. If you want to hear a short summary of the most important info in this extremely interesting book, you can do so at Leogent.com. You can listen to this and many other base titles in under 25 minutes. The difference between Leogent and other similar platforms is that only Leogent covers the really relevant books on topics such as our evolutionary origins as Europeans. So try it now. Go to Leogent.com now and sign up with my promo code TJH to get 10% off.
Are you ready for the future of the West?